We were speaking about the Department of Industrial Design. General Motors, when I got there, had this department. They call it their Industrial Design Department. And it was composed of a lot of designers who weren't involved in automotive work at all. And they were working, at the time I got there, they were working on this Train of Tomorrow sort of thing, where they were doing Astrodomes for General Motors, for Electromotive Division, their train. And they were doing this sort of thing. And then they also became involved in Frigidaire's work. They did Frigidaire's ranges.
Frigidaire was a GM...
GM subsidiary, household appliances.
Right. Uh-huh.
So they did all of the appliances for Frigidaire.
Did they? Design as well as engineering?
Preliminary engineering, but all the engineering, of course, was done down at Dayton.
Yeah.
At Frigidaire Manufacturing. But they had engineers that worked up there, as well as industrial designers who worked in this aspect of it.
Was
along
under Harley Earl?
This was all under Harley Earl. And along with it, they had designers who were exhibit designers who worked on shows. Because any shows that came along, if you were going to exhibit your products, you had to have a way of making a very attractive presentation.
Right.
Earl, recognizing this, started the exhibit design group up there.
Mm.
And
really far out.
It was far out, and it showed that he was very interested in industrial design even at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the big industrial designer at that time was the one who had done for General Motors, and probably got Earl mostly interested in it, was Norman Bel Geddes, who did their World's Fair ride of tomorrow, in their Futuramic ride. At the New York World's Fair back in 1964, that was 1939 and 40.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the Triline and Perisphere theme?
World
of Tomorrow.
Yes.
And Norman Bel Geddes did that. Well, at that time, the corporation brought him in there, and Earl was going to put some of his people on it, but he recognized that he did not have capable designers to handle this aspect of design. So that's when the Industrial Design Department was born.
Did Earl bring Norman Bel Geddes in to do the Futurama?
No, the corporation did that.
I wonder who had the impetus, who had the idea to do that.
I don't know who did that at the time.
Stroke of luck,
it really was.
Because that was the hit of the fair, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it was.
World of Tomorrow?
The World of Tomorrow.
Yeah, Futurama.
Yeah. In fact, the ride that they did subsequently at World Fairs, the one that they did in 1964 and 5, was actually a throwback with a bit of a change to Norman Bel Geddes' original idea.
So the Industrial Design Department was probably a real pioneering effort in the industry, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, as far as the corporation was concerned.
You combined the multiple talents of the design department, the engineering department, and probably even product planning.
Yes, it did, in all of them. So this part worked very well. The man who was in charge of this Industrial Design Department when I started there right after that, I started. He left, and he went out to teach at Art Center School, teach design. He was a Californian. His name was George Jergensen, and
J-E-R-G-E-N-S-E-N.
Mm-hmm. And George Jergensen went out to California at Art Center School, and he was teacher out there. He was actually the head of the school under the man who owned it. George was one of the founders of the school. And he got the thing organized. So he'd been out there all these years. So they got another man by the name of Roy Kiefer. Roy Kiefer headed the organization then until he retired and passed away shortly afterward. And it was during this time that I noticed that the lettering on automobiles just was very crude and very immature in appearance. And it was. And I mentioned this to Bill Mitchell because most of the designers weren't schooled in lettering. It's a specialty all of its own. So I talked to Bill and said it'd be a good idea to get someone from the advertising profession to come in, and maybe even a small department started in this line. They could also work on instrument panels, lettering, and some of the speedometers and the rest of it. Mitchell agreed and hired a couple of young fellows, and that's how the lettering department was born, and that also then became a part of the industrial design section. But the industrial design department then under Kiefer was responsible for all of the exhibit design at the World's Fairs, at a lot of our showrooms, and then we even, I say we, General Motors design staff, even got the contract of doing a lot of the exhibit design work for various divisions. And then they would pay a styling for the amount of work. So Earl then put it on a paying basis, and it was making money for the corporation. Although we had the men on our payroll at design staff. And so the Motoramas were conceived by Earl. And I think the first one came around 1950, 52, 53. And the exhibit design group then, under Kiefer, is the one that did all the backgrounds and made the presentation of all the models in the Waldorf Astoria. And these Motoramas traveled around the country. They went to Boston, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and they were well attended. As a matter of fact, down in New York, they had to get these big barriers out to keep people from falling into the street. They lined up for two blocks waiting to get in because it was a free show to the public. And it was a beautiful show. It featured not only our automobiles, all of our General Motors products, but also dancers, singers, and a complete show. An ongoing stage show. It was beautiful.
Can you describe the physical aspect of these autoramas? How were they?
Well, they were held in the main ballroom at the Waldorf Astoria. That's where they started out. And he used the Waldorf because it's a name spot in New York City. And the exhibit design group under Kiefer came out with a magnificent presentation device, which would really be like a huge hand holding the automobile and then moving out into the wings, and then another one, there were five of them, and another one would move back down onto the stage under the spotlight after the presentation was made on that model, along with dancers and singers and what have you. That would slide back, and simultaneously another one would come out of the shadows down into the bright lights with another product on it until all five cars were accounted for. And it was a very huge undertaking, and it worked very, very well.
Mm-hmm. They traveled also in large vans, did they not?
Yes, they traveled in large vans by semis, went around the country that way. There was so much stuff, you really couldn't move it any other way.
Were certain personnel assigned to the Motorama, say?
Yes, they were. They were in public relations. Fisher Body had its people they would assign. Each of the divisions had its people assigned to it to see that everything went well. I remember one time going down, happened to be in Boston one time, and with the public relations guy from Pontiac, and we just make up certain dresses for the girls that would be shown with the models with the automobiles. And so he put out a call down there for girls, but they had to be a specific size. Then they had to come in and read their lines, and he had to audition all of them. So I went in there with him while he was auditioning some of these girls, and he really felt sorry for some of the little girls because some of them were just, they wanted the job very badly, but they had to fit into these tight gowns, and they would zip themselves into the gowns, and they were just so terribly uncomfortable in there. It was very, very apparent, and they were trying to read their lines, and you felt sorry that they weren't going to make it, and you had to tell them in a nice way, and I kind of felt sorry for the PR guy having to go through that with this horde of women out there who all wanted the job.
Well, at this point, you've come up with in 1958, you've come up with a interesting fiberglass prototype. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How it happened? Why it happened?
Well, we made the fiberglass prototype show some of the newest thinking, having the advanced studios at that time. We wanted an advanced prototype that showed all the latest thinking in the corporation. Went to Guide Lamp to see what they were working on, and it was their electrical supplier,
right.
Headlamps and so on. And so we went there and we're trying to get new configurations for headlamps for the car. And so my group came up with the idea of having long, narrow, rectangular headlamps. Well, this presents certainly an engineering problem because you have to get the depth of beam, and you had high and low beam, and you also have to get them squeezed down into this small form, which we're doing just strictly for appearance. And Guide Lamp wasn't too receptive on working too hard on it. So what we did, we had a fellow, it was a Chinese fellow by the name of John Yi, an engineer, who used to work on a lot of our lighting. So we prevailed upon John to come up with some of the backing and some of the reflectors that would make this plausible. And while it wasn't 100% perfected, we did it to the point that it convinced, making a physical model, we've convinced a guide lamp that it was possible. And as a result, an outgrowth of the rectangular seal beams came out of this, yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, Harley Earl was the one that brought back the idea of the twin lamps. Do you remember when they came out with the dual circular lamps?
Mm-hmm.
That was Earl's idea.
And did he pick that up?
He picked that up because they used to use those. Santa Fe used to use those on their railroad, and he took a train out there. He noticed some of these lights switching back and forth, and they had two lights on the front of some of the trains. But that's Earl also picked up another thing from them. Years ago, before I ever got started there, there were a lot of lamps that you could buy at Western Auto Supply stores and so on that had a blue button in the middle. A tail lamp. It was a red lamp with a blue button in the middle of it. And that gave it a little distinction, almost like it looked like a purple light at night. Earl brought that back, and he called that the Santa Fe lamp, because Santa Fe used to use that on the back of their railroad cars, on their cabooses, and he thought that was neat, so he bought it back and put it on cars. It was just an innovation, but it was something else. The rest of them were putting red on, and Earl was putting the one on with the blue dots. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Well, what was this dual intake grill that was so successful, and how did it come about?
Well, on the that was the last Pontiac I worked on. It was the 59 Pontiac. We needed a new theme. We were doing a new automobile, so
a new Pontiac
from 1959. The body had pretty much been worked out. And it was a C body, and here we were going in, we needed a new A body. There wasn't enough money to come up with a new A body at the time, so they decided, why just don't we take the C body, give it to Chevrolet and Pontiac, and see what we can come up with. Well, part of it turned out good and part of it didn't. Pontiac's worked out good because John DeLorean put the wide track on the Pontiac, so that we had a wide body, you see. But the rest of them, like Chevrolet, had a narrower track because they usually use the A-body. So they used the A-body track, and they were given this C-body to work with. So if you looked at it in profile, it was all right. But if you looked at it head-on or rearward, you'd see the wheels were well inset under the body, and it looked like the body was overpowering the automobile, which in effect it really was.
And
overbalanced, really. And it wasn't good on cornering and a lot of things. So at any rate, in order to make the car look good, I worked out a front end, and I like this idea of a dual theme type of a front end, twin grill openings. So I started out by taking, there was the one that Mitchell wanted in there that we were working on, but I took the hood contour and took a piece of cardboard, a great big sheet of illustration board, put two of them together, had the paint shop spray it clay color to match the clay, then I pinned it on the front of the car with heavy pins. Then I carved out these two openings to see how it would look. Then I took chrome tape and put around the periphery of the openings so that looking at it from a distance, it gave you at least the appearance of a front end without going through all the modeling. And Bill Mitchell did not like this. Jules Andrade liked it. He was a sort of a design assistant that went around with
Earl,
yeah. And but then he continued on after Earl went out. He continued on with Bill, because he was Bill Senior, really, an old guy. So
Andrade
liked it, and he thought it was great. I took pictures of that, and the fellows in the studio thought it was great. Bunky Knudsen thought it was great, so we started to model it. You know, and we did Bill's over here, so we brought another buck over and started to model the one I was doing. Bill didn't like that very well. And so he then got enough people behind him from the corporation, brought him in, talked him into what he thought covered the other one up, covered mine up, and told him, he's the boss. Bill Mitchell had, yeah. So, because Bill got back there about 1954 or 55, I think he came back again. back into the swing of things. So Bill then was the big man, you see, because Earl was kind of on his way out. He wasn't, as I explained, that was his last model, and Earl wasn't quite as sure of himself as he should have been. So Bill was there. So anyway, Bill wanted his. So he finally talked Knudsen into it, and the corporation into going with this other type of grill. But what happened was, and the one that I had worked on at that particular time, everyone thought it was the way to go. And then I was transferred. This was in late 1957. And I was transferred into run two advanced rooms. I was given advanced one and two. And so I was out of there, and I didn't have anything to say about it. So they brought Szymanski back in there to run Pontiac. Wow. So he started working on the one Bill did, but then he put this big monolithic front on the thing, and they didn't like it up at Pontiac. They didn't like Szymanski too well either. Bunky Knudsen didn't like him, DeLorean and Pete Estes. So he was okay, he was a nice guy, but he just didn't seem to have what they wanted. So anyway, they went for this other front end. And mine was
gathering dust.
So Knudsen came back and said, "God damn it, this is the one I want. Bill, it's my car. I'll be responsible for it. This is the one I got." So he got his way, and he prevailed, and that's the one that they came out with. And DeLorean, mine went almost straight across. DeLorean told me eventually, his contribution was to bring it up a little bit up at the end over the headlamp, see? Straight on the bottom, a little up over the headlamps, a bit like that. Put a little grill texture behind it. And that ended up being the 59 Pontiac. Most of it was all done, but that was the thing that was hanging fire. And good, but they just had to come out with something to the end because you had to release for engineering.
It was very successful.
It was very, very successful. That's the dual theme that has followed right on through in the Pontiacs for ever since. Now, there was a book written here by, it's Pontiac Years here. I got the book here in my briefcase. Mm-hmm. And a guy by the name of Jan Norby and another guy wrote the thing. And I wrote them a letter because I saw the book there, and they had talked to Jack Humbert, who later was a chief designer in there. And Jack, and Jack Humbert wasn't even in there at the time. He was down somewhere, and he told him that he thought that was a Szymanski front end, and it's in the book. So I write to this guy, and I got a letter back from him from Paris that he's over there now, this Norby, and he says, "God, he's sorry as hell. You know, if any changes go through on the thing, he'll see that it's corrected and everything. He really wishes he'd talk to me. Blah blah blah," but. Jack didn't have anything to do with that. He wasn't even in there at the time, and Joe didn't have anything to do with it. See, Joe's dad was a
Szymanski.
Was a I used to kid him about it because Joe's dad had a Tombstone outfit, and he was running that. When Joe got out of art school, he went to work for his old man doing these big goddamn Tombstone. I said, "Hey, front you do one there, looks like a Tombstone, Joe." and I still think he did on the, then they wanted to get rid of it. Mitchell still didn't think that the 59 Pontiac front was that good. So the following year, he had Szymanski do this great big front. They brought it out. The dealers kicked like hell. It wasn't accepted anywhere. The following year, they brought the dual theme back, changed it a little bit, and they've been used it ever since.
That's
So it shows you that you can be a top man and be perceptive and be pretty smart, but you can make mistakes like anybody else. And Mitchell did on that one.
But in spite of that, Mitchell asked you to work for him at this point, in a sense, did he not?
Well, I was working for him, that I was doing all of we kept expanding the
advanced design studios,
and pretty soon we had six of them. We had a preliminary design studio, and we had in a couple of studios there I do overseas and Canadian stuff. Well, see, because Lauer had done some stuff on Canadian Pontiacs, Bob Lauer had done stuff on Pontiacs. Years ago, when they used to kind of convert old Chevys to Pontiacs, Lauer being in Chevy and Pontiac studio, would just cobble up something, put on. So he got to know the Canadian guys. So my association with them was a natural outgrowth of my job in Pontiac.
Yeah.
And so I was in charge of the design for the Canadian stuff because they were changing a lot of their cars then. One of the cars the Canadians wanted to do, they were importing Vauxhalls, and one of the cars they wanted to bring in was a Vauxhall Victor.
Now, Vauxhall was the
Subsidiary of General Motors in London. Outside of London, Luton, England. So they made the Vauxhall cars over there, a real old organization. They used to have race cars, and they were well thought of in the early days. V-A-U-X-H-A-L-L. So the Canadians had a Victor that they wanted to convert, and they wanted to call it the Viscount over there. So they needed some changes. So they brought it, had a car shipped over to one of my studios. We went about to change it to make a car, got the Canadians over and the top people all over. They all approved this is the way to go. But then the present GM was in at the time. It was old, what the hell was his name? Remember the guy that apologized to Ralph Nader?
Yeah.
So it's funny how you forget these names, and yet they're so well known, because I know the man well. Anyway, he was in there, and he said, well, Paul, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go over to Vauxhall. I want you to go over there with the sales manager of GM Canada. And we're also going to send another fellow. So they sent an interior guy over, Jay Snyder, who is an engineer, expediter type of guy in the interior group. So that we flew over there, and the guy's name was Canada was Jeff Humphrey, and Jeff was a sales manager. Everybody loved him there. God, he really was a real powerful speaker. He was a Billy Graham type of guy, and so everyone loved him. He started out as a clergyman, and then he became that. So we went over there with him, and he'd been to England many times. So Jay and I, being younger, he wanted to show us the ropes, and we went out to some nice places and so on. We stayed at the Dorchester Hotel, and he had a suite in there with liquor all over the table and flowers, you know, being sales manager, Canadians fixed that up for him, and the Vauxhall people. Jay and I had a suite down at the other end, nice big living room, bedroom on each end. It was really a nice place. So we stayed there, and we got acquainted there. We went out to the meeting that old Jeff was conducting out at Vauxhall. The Vauxhall people were all the top people were involved in, including the factory managers and all of them. We outlined what had been approved by the president of General Motors at that time, and they thought they might be able to do it. And Jeff Humphrey said, "You better do it. We're buying this automobile. If we're going to buy it and sell it in Canada, this is what you're going to have. It's already been approved, and we want it." "Well, we think we can get that. And how many colors?" "Well, we need some more colors. We need special colors. Can you get the special color?" "Well, I guess we can. Now, we need this. We need the special tail lamps. We need this and that, blah, blah." I went over it. "Special, different interiors. Can you?" "Well, yeah, they thought, well, we don't know, sir, whether we might be able to." Okay, so they talked to the general manager there at Vauxhall, and he said, "Fine." So Jeff had to get back to Canada. So he said, "Okay, I'll leave it up to Paul. I'll leave it up to you and Jay." So he told the guy, "Paul Gillen and Jay Snyder are going to represent me here. They'll be working with you on this to get the whole program accomplished. They might have to be over here a while." Fine. So the general manager invites us out to his home, and we had a nice time out there, and he said servants and the whole bit, English bit with his horses and the whole, that was very impressive, you know, but with the idea that he's Mr. Big and you better do it his way. Then he gets talking to his people, and the factory people say, "Well, they can't add any more paint lines in there, you know, because there's more paint lines. There just isn't room for more tubs of paint in there. You can't get more paint lines in there." Then the guy comes in from the lamp department, and he says, "They can't possibly get a new tail lamp that would fit back in the old fender. Get a new tail lamp for this Viscount. They can't get one of those until, maybe anywhere from 12 to 18 months before they can get a new one." "Why didn't you tell Mr. Humphrey that yesterday?" "Well, we didn't know that, sir. We didn't know it at that time. But, well, but God, here we stuck with a dog over here, and there's nothing we can do about it, and they're leaving it up to us." So I had copies of this meeting we made here, and I put them all over here, and I said, "The president of General Motors has sent me over here to see that this is going to be done. This is what he asked for. It would behoove all of us to get it done, and I'm here to see that it's going to get done, and I'll show you how it can happen." So what I did was went through the factory with Jeff, we talked at different places, wrote down what these stations were, and says, "Why can't you talk to the guys working there? Is there any reason why you can't put these extra barrels of paint on the other side of the wall out here and just run your hoses in?" "Why, no, sir, there's no reason we can't do that." "Okay, we can do that and do that." Went over here, and then what I did was I called up Guide Lamp in Detroit, or down in Anderson, Indiana. I knew the contacts there. I called him up. I said, "How long would it take you to tool a lamp?" I told him about how big the thing was and how it looked similar to a certain type of Pontiac lamp. "How long would it take you to tool a lamp like this? I mean, Canada needs this damn thing. We'd bring the car in to Canada, sans tail lamp. Then the Canadians could mount this damn thing, and your guide would get the business." "Well, hell, they could do it between 3 and 4 months, see?" "Very good." So we got all the answers of the whole thing, and the rest of the things that they couldn't even work it out in time and so on. We got all that taken care of. The next day, from Lucas Lamp Company over in England, did all the Lucas lamps for them over there. They got old Joe Lucas and some of his guys out there because they heard that Guide was going to make the goddamn tail lamp. They got it out, and goddamn it, they got down where they could get it done in 4 months. So they got the thing done, and they put the paint thing out, and we got everything that we wanted out of the damn thing. So the Canadians like that. Well, then they told Bill about it, and that put me in good over there. See, on the overseas thing, from there on, this was way back in, I don't know, 59, I guess, it was when I first went over there. So then I had the overseas tour. So then I was on over all the overseas thing, got things accomplished all over. And I went over there, and Opel, Bill said, I want you to go over there.
Who's this?
Bill Mitchell asked me to go over to Opel.
Opel?
Yeah.
Which was?
Which was a subsidiary of General Motors in Germany, over at over in Germany.
What city was that?
That's over in, it's right outside of Frankfurt. It's called Rüsselsheim. It's in Rüsselsheim, Germany. Rüsselsheim, in Rüsselsheim, Germany. So I went over there, and they had a guy Bill had known for many years, about Bill's age or so, and Carl Mager, his name was, and he was in charge of the design section. But the design section over there was really under the chief engineer.
They were in the old mode.
And they were in the old mode, and whatever he said went. Well, there was something in the Nazi hierarchy during the thing where the guy who was the chief engineer was a Nazi guy, and even under, old Carl didn't want to get in the thing, but he was kind of stabbing him a little bit, but now he didn't want any more part of it, but Carl still knew that he'd been in the Nazi thing, one of those deals, you know. So I got in that afternoon, and boy, he was out there at the car. Chief engineer, trying to think of his name. A nice guy, he was a pretty nice guy and everything, you know, because we're coming from the States and he had to be nice.
Sure.
So he took us out there and went to dinner and the whole thing. And they sent Szymanski with me at that time. Joe and I both went over on that one. So the next day we went out, and the styling section there was up on the roof, and there was like an upper story built on the roof of the factory, and this is where the styling was done, and you'd walk out of one door and you'd have to walk across this pebbled roof to into the door of the styling section, you know, up on the third deck. And what a hell of a thing it was in there. And then Carl Mager, who ran the design section, didn't.
Carl.
Pardon?
That's what Mager's
on. Mager. And so he, working for the chief engineer over there, his name was Hans Mersheimer, was the chief engineer. So he was working for Hans Mersheimer, and he had to do what Mersheimer did. So some of the guys I got talking to, and you know the designers, you know, they're nice guys, and get talking to them, they said, well, Jesus, this guy, Mager, you know, he has to do what Mersheimer said. But Mersheimer, we put out all these seats. They had all this trim stuff to show it what they had and everything. But Mersheimer always selects this one and this one. And I'll tell you why. We all know why. Because the guy that runs the vinyl works, or the plastic company that puts out all this stuff down there, you want to see the presents he gives Mersheimer at Christmas time. Mersheimer's house is filled with presents, and the ones that give him the presents are the one whose stuff he selects. And this sort of thing, you know, no kid. Oh yeah, that's the way it goes. Of course, over in the States you can't do that. See, because everyone signs a thing where you can't. But anyway, in Germany, they didn't catch up with it yet.
Mersheimer
is M-E-R S-C-H-E-I-M-E-R. Yeah, so he ran that whole operation with a real tight fist. So we went down.
You had quite a thing to unravel there, didn't you?
Yeah.
And how'd you do it?
Well, we finally got the thing all set. Some of the designs weren't so good. We worked with it and with them there. Worked with them on the full size stuff and the type of thing. Well, what we'd done was this: before we went over, Bill Mitchell had to send all their stuff over to Mitchell. Their line drawings. In one of my studios, we got some stuff that Mitchell liked. We designed the car the way we thought, so we took the stuff over with us. He folded up, put them up on the boards up there, and their guys then made overlays and put it against their cars so you could see how they stacked up. What we wanted to do was start a model that looked like this. So they did, and we were there. While we were there, they were working on part of the model to get part of the thing done. We were there quite a little while. We got the thing so it looked quite good. Mersheimer kind of went along with it. There was a guy, I forget the general manager's name at the time, he was a nice guy, but he wasn't in it at all. He never went to the design staff, didn't care about engineering. He was a sales manager type, and he just didn't give a damn about stuff. So we went out, spent a lot of time over there at their design staff, their styling section, and head of GM at that time had asked me to write.
Who was that?
This fellow, we were trying to remember his name.
Yeah, okay.
Remember? You remember the guy, don't you? Anyway, so when I got back, I had then from there I went over to Vauxhall. I went to Vauxhall. Davy Jones was the chief designer at Vauxhall, the director of design. So when I got back, Mitchell said, "Here's what I want you to do." Even when I was over there, he said, "I want you to write a report for me." And exactly what you think we ought to do with the design, and what is your impression of the design staff at Opal, and what is your impression of the design staff over at Vauxhall, and what do you think ought to be done? So this was a report for Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, knowing Mitchell real well, hell, I just wrote up exactly what I thought they ought to do. I wrote about all the guys. I wrote about Mearsheimer selecting the stuff because of getting his stuff in his pocket,
right,
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The whole bit, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I said he was a nice man, which he was and everything, but I wrote the whole story up. Mitchell, I just wrote it in everyday language, you know, just as though I was talking to you now.
Mm-hmm.
And Mitchell thought, God, this is really something. So what does he do? He takes it downtown and gives it to the president of General Motors and the chairman of the board,
mm-hmm,
each a copy of the thing. Well, they read it over, and they says, well, God damn it, we're going to make some changes. So they decided to make some changes, and they took a trip over there with Mitchell. They agreed with me on the thing. They decided that Magro should be phased out. We ought to take and put another guy over there, an American guy that Mitchell would trust, to go over and run the design staff and appropriate money to build a new building. So the corporation then, at the next big meeting, appropriated money to build a brand new building for a design staff over there at Rüsselsheim, Opel, in Germany, which they did. And they built a beautiful building over there, so that upgraded them. Then at the same time, there was an engineering building already started over at Vauxhall. They decided to take the top part of that and make it a design staff for Davy Jones at Vauxhall. So they got a brand new thing over there.
They had a design at Vauxhall in England.
In England, yeah.
So that was all your doing.
Well, it was because of my...
Your career as an overseas design specialist.
Are we on the air right now?
Yes.
Well, we're speaking about the design staffs being built over at both Vauxhall and Opel with their new buildings and so on. From there on, it just rapidly matured, and everyone, of course, was very, very glad. And the products that came out have just been very successful ever since. But a lot of it, of course, is due to the fact that they also made some changes over there in management about that time. Because knowing that some of this stuff was happening in design staff, in engineering, they also decided to take a look at their complete engineering staff over there, including the fellows that were running the factories, and to see that they were well qualified. Up to that time, overseas had been an old organization of General Motors. They were headquartered out of New York City. They were all gentlemen, good fellows. They would, the GM, stateside representatives would pretty much take what was ever recommended to them engineering-wise and design-wise when they arrived. In those days, they were still used to, not in the airplane age, they were still used to taking the boat. And all of the top people would take the boat over to Europe. Well, if something, you know, they're talking on the phone and they take the boat, they get there a week or so later. They take the boat back. And the fellow that went over to Australia used to take the boat. They used to have a man to go over to help on overseas projects. He would take the boat, and it'd be 3 months before he got back from Australia to let the corporation know what the hell was happening over there. And this sort of thing couldn't happen. So then the corporation became a lot more interested in overseas stuff. And Ford Motor Company was making a lot of strides in this direction, and General Motors realized they had to too, and they did. And as a result of that, one day I was down in Toronto with Bill Mitchell and the top Canadian management group, and Steve McDaniel. We had lunch late and a couple of drinks, and one day Bill was very proud to offer me the job of the director of design for Adam Opel. And he said, "How would you feel about that?" And I didn't have to hesitate. Maybe if I had, it would have even sounded better. But I said, "No, Bill, I thank you very much, but I really would rather stay in the States." Well, I had personal reasons at that particular time, what with my family involvement and so on. I wasn't able at that time to make a change. Mitchell had offered me something, and I guess I should have been very grateful, but because I didn't accept it, he never quite forgot that. And his treatment of me, his attitude toward me, seemed to be just a little more strained after that as a result. He then, we had Davy Jones, who'd been a longtime friend of Bill's and who was in charge of design, an Englishman at Vauxhall, and was a very capable man. He was willing to stay on. But since they wanted to make the change at Opal, they were looking for a man. So they asked Irv Rubicki, who was running Chevrolet Studio at the time, if he would accept the job. And I guess Irv was in an Oldsmobile at that time. They asked Irv if he would accept the job. Irv said, give him a week. He thought it over. At the end of a week, he said no. He just wouldn't be able to accept it.
How do you spell
Rubicki? Rubicki is now the vice president of General Motors in charge of
design.
His name is spelled Rybicki, Irvin Rubicki. And Irv didn't take the job either. So then he asked Claire McKeegan. Claire McKeegan was running Chevy. That's right at that time. So McKeegan jumped at it. He took it. McKeegan is McKichan. So Mac took the job, and he went over and became the first American director at Opal. Had a nice home over there, which they provided him with, up in an area where, up on the hill, where all the top executives for Opal live, and a beautiful view, very nice place. And Mac liked it very much. He seemed to get along over there, and because of Mac's attitude, he's a strict, stern, Scotch descendant type of guy, very Spartan with his conversation and so on. And the Germans seemed to, at least he got the job done, whether or not they really liked him as a man. And I used to travel back and forth, and I used to see Mac over there frequently. A lot of the things I saw, even though Mac was over there, I didn't approve of them. So I would come back, make recommendations in my studio, get Mitchell's approval and the approval of overseas management in this country, take it over, and Mac would then implement it in his design studios. And Mac had somewhat, he was a complete authority over there. He, while he owed his position there to Bill Mitchell, and indirectly to me for having gone over there originally, he resented the fact that I would come over there and bring changes that occurred in one of my studios. And he would go ahead with it grudgingly because he knew the consequences with Mitchell if he didn't. However, my relationship with McKeegan was never that good from there on either. But I did enjoy traveling. One of my jobs was to go to the European auto shows each year. I'd been doing that for many years. I go to the Paris show first, then the London show, and then the Turin show. Later, Turin show came in the spring.
Turin was the center of
Italian design activity.
Right.
And
Turino.
Torino, yes. So, in fact, Ford called one of the cars the Torino after that. So I used to travel around over there. When I got there, I would call GM France or GM London and arrange for a photographer. Sometimes a still photographer and oftentimes a movie photographer, and we'd go out to the auto show early in the morning. I'd usually go the day before and make notes of everything that I thought was new and all the cars that I wanted to highlight. Then we'd go out and take photographs and movies of these automobiles, and they'd develop them, send them back to the States, and I'd make presentation here to design staff and to General Motors Corporation on what I considered the latest design innovations on European cars. Mm-hmm. And this, we found it very helpful.
But in spite of the position in which you enjoyed the traveling and the prestige of being a sort of a home office troubleshooter for the European operation, it really wasn't what you had wanted to do. You preferred to be back designing.
I liked designing. That was my first love, and art and design. I liked that sort of thing. I did like, I got to the point where I did like traveling quite a bit. I used to go to South America frequently. Mm-hmm. Loved it. You can't help but like it to a large extent. I didn't like being away from my family all that much, but I did like traveling. For example, you know, you're traveling first class. You stay at the very best hotels. You have the finest food. You meet a lot of interesting people. When you get there, because you are a dignitary, so to speak, from the States, from the home office, they treat you nicely. They put on little cocktail parties for you. You always had chauffeurs. And you get VIP treatment. And that was very gratifying. And you go to South America and have a weekend to spend by yourself, and you go from São Paulo, fly over to Rio, spend the whole weekend in Rio, and just really enjoy yourself. Go over to the local yacht club down there go to their pool and swim, and just, you know, meet fellows with boats down there in Rio, and it's a very nice life.
Did you get down to Australia, though?
I'd been to Australia once, years ago. Later on, Bill Mitchell got that job, and then Bill got Chuck Jordan for an assistant, and Chuck reserved the Australian deal for himself because Chuck was a Californian. Chuck would fly to California, stay over there, then he'd fly to Hawaii, he'd stay a few days in Hawaii, then he'd fly to Fiji, from Fiji he'd go over to Australia, which was the route they'd sent us on. But he'd spend it down there because he liked being away. So that was a long trip. See, the one he'd been to Europe several times, but he kind of liked the long one. And then he got, later on, they would tie that trip into a Japan trip. So he'd go from Australia over to Japan.
In terms of overseas operations, give us a little historical background, if you will. It's my impression that Ford had established first European subsidiaries largely out of from a beginning, but that General Motors seemed to prefer to take over established, if somewhat smaller companies and make them into their subsidiaries. Is that the way it happened with Vauxhall in England and
yes,
Opel in Germany?
Yes, both Vauxhall and Opel started out that way.
Were they small automobile companies?
They were, no, actually they're quite large automobile companies by the time the corporation took them over.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the one over at Holden's over in Australia, they used to make, Holden's was a company that used to make custom bodies. They used to make a body they called the calèche, which was off an old horse-drawn carriage type of thing. They used to make the calèche, C-A-L-A-I-S-C-H, I guess, and they used to make that. And they had quite good engineering works. Then they would take some American cars over there and customize them and work on them, and that became Holden's. So as a result, they had facilities for manufacturing, and the General Motors bought them and started manufacturing automobiles, actually doing the engines, castings, and the whole bit.
So mm-hmm. That was tailor-made for them.
That was, yes.
What about, you mentioned Adam Opel. Was that their original name?
Their name was Adam Opel. That was the man's name who started it. He started making sewing machines and bicycles.
In the early part of the century?
Probably in the late 1800s,
late,
I guess.
The latter part of the
last century.
Century, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so he made what?
He made, Adam Opel made sewing machines and bicycles. And then he got into early automobiles over there, you know, after Daimler and Benz and the rest of them in Germany did. He started making cars. At Vauxhall, they used to make marine engines to begin with, and they were located right down along the Thames River. And then when the cars started coming in, why, they just making pretty good engines, a couple of small automobile companies bought their engines, and they decided they may as well go into the business themselves. So then they got into the automobile business and then phased out the marine engine business.
And so General Motors, sensing in these two areas an opportunity to take over an established industrial plant,
mm-hmm.
Expanded them into their overseas facilities.
Yes, that's true.
They do that in South America too.
In South America, they started their own. They started the Chevrolet down at São Paulo, Brazil, and they bought existing buildings. I don't know who was in them before Chevrolet, but they started manufacturing Chevrolets down in Brazil. They started manufacturing Chevrolets, but then Brazil had a local content law where you had to have about 90% local content. So as a result, we couldn't, and they had import laws, so we couldn't export our Chevys from here down there, or even our parts, except for maybe 10% local content, so that we had established manufacturing facilities down there. Well, it was built practically verbatim, design-wise, engineering and design-wise, to the American cars. And then they began to manufacture Chevrolets in Argentina.
I wondered about that.
And so I used to go down to Buenos Aires, Argentina also,
uh-huh.
And they used to do their cars down there. It was very, very interesting.
Now Ford had sort of gotten a head start on them, had they? I think Henry Ford
II,
right after World War II, decided that there should be an overseas operation.
That's what I understand, yeah. You see, General Motors overseas, as I understand it, in the early days, used to just started out shipping all kinds of batteries and wheels and tires and transmissions and parts and stuff like that over to Egypt and different places where they would get a car and they would make sort of a hybrid out of it. And then General Motors decided to get in the car business over there, which they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked out very well.
Yeah, then of course for a while they used to have their Frigidaire plant outside of Paris, and they used to make Frigidaires. Of course they phased that out also.
Did they?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a sort of a bittersweet kind of experience for you. You're pleased with the recognition you're getting. You're pleased mm-hmm. with the work you're doing, and you're pleased with the expanding the design centers overseas.
Yes.
But it's not designing, is it?
It's not designing. No, I love to design automobiles. I liked being in charge of the advanced group, though. I could design in there. I mean, you're working
yes.
with the actual designers. When the World's Fair, last World's Fair we had came along, which was in 64 and 5,
yes, I
frequently went back and forth to New York with Roy Kiefer's boys, Jack Didion and his group. That while they did the World's Fair, they did the entire building, designed the building. Jack Didion and his group designed that building.
D-I-T-T-Y?
D-I-D-I-O-N. Jack Didion.
D-I-D-I-O-N.
Yeah. And Jack and his group, Jack was a good architect, a good designer, and a good guy all the way around. Jack and his group designed most of that, with Kiefer heading the thing up here. Kiefer was getting pretty old at the time, and Jack and his group handled that. And then they did the sets for the whole thing. Well, they, along with the sets, it's all transportation-oriented, being General Motors, so we needed the finest contemporary designs we could get. So they wrote a story. What they were going to have was an underseas area to go through on this ride. Mm-hmm. Were you through that, Dave?
No.
An underseas area. They also had, like, similar to the earlier World's Fair, a World of Tomorrow that you go through. They had an Arctic section. They had a jungle scene where roads were being laid through there and all sorts of things. That means you had to have vehicles for all these things. And so being an advanced design group, it was up to me to come up and meet what they had set up as a set and design vehicles for all of these different operations, underseas and Arctic vehicles and all of them. So along with that, we had three cars that we did, way out cars. So I had a meeting in our auditorium and put out a notice for all of the designers to meet in the auditorium, all of General Motors designers, and be there for a 10 o'clock meeting. So I gave them a background of what we were attempting to have at the World's Fair, the background of the thing. Jack Didion told them what was going to happen, and I told them what we were going to need in the way of vehicles. And we listed them up there. And I wanted to find out who were the most interested people, who would like to take part in this, and to leave their names when they left the auditorium, which they did. Some fellas like it, some don't. So those that did, let me know. Then I went into the studio to look over a lot of their portfolios to see what type of work they were working on. Then I got Mitchell's okay to take over a studio down in a building where the World's Fair stuff was being developed. The General Motors had rented down on Mound Road. So I took over a large area for a studio there. We shipped in the necessary equipment. We shipped seven or eight designers in there at a time. They'd stay for a 2 to 3 week period until they were designed dry, so to speak, on the particular project. We'd send another group in. And at that time, we were able to come up with vehicles for the whole show. We had vehicles in the jungle that would cut down trees, that would pour cement, and do the whole thing. And these were believable because we got top engineers in to look at the thing, and they said they were production feasible. And we did the same thing with underseas vehicles, and it worked out great. Then I also did the had the three automobiles that
what
we presented with
them.
Well, one was called was a shopper type of vehicle.
Called an idea car.
They were all idea cars, yeah. And we had the idea cars down there. One was a shopper. In the back of that, we had a shopping cart, but it was a three-wheel vehicle. And the lower under part of the car, the trunk, was actually a shopping cart with retractable wheels. So the gal would go back there, open up the back light, turn a button, the wheels would come onto the shopping cart, it would let itself down, we'd pull it out, you take it in the supermarket, just bring it back, plug it in the back of the car, the wheels would retract, and you drive it home, and you could wheel it right into your kitchen.
Gosh, they still haven't adopted
No, they haven't. And it was a pretty neat little arrangement. It worked good. Then we did another car called the AMX, which was started out being called the Stiletto. It had a real bullet nose. Mitchell always liked a real pointed nose. Yeah, and later, after the show, so that Pontiac could use the car to show around, we put a complete different front on it because, you know, with safety regulations coming into the fore at that time, just absolutely was the wrong way to go. But we did show it that way at the World's Fair, and it created a lot of attention. It was an interior-exterior model. We had a lot of good exposure with that. Then we did another, a sedan type, a way out, Turnpike Cruiser, we called it.
Did you?
Yeah, it had seats that would television in it, seats that would swivel in there. It could lock into computerized road systems and so on.
Ford had one of that.
Yeah.
Earlier,
yeah, they had a Turnpike Cruiser one time.
They had dropped the trademark, apparently.
Yeah, well, maybe we didn't even call it the Turnpike Cruiser. I don't know. But what we did, we had a lot of different names for these things, see? But yeah. I said the one was called the Turnpike Cruiser. No, the other bird, we called it, we started out calling it Turnpike Cruiser sort of thing. It became Firebird 4.
Four. Okay.
Yeah, that was
yes,
a Firebird
right.
4, see?
Uh-huh.
We had it that time. That was a turbo job. This was the
side view.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
This is the interior of the GMX.
GMX, uh-huh.
Yeah, that, this is the GMX job. See, that's what the point I was telling
yes,
you about. We later rounded that all off and just left the scoops on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the other little car up on top.
What was that called?
We call that the runabout. It was actually a shopper vehicle.
The shopper runabout. Oh,
yeah.
There it is. You're able to use the cart as an integral part of it. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Well,
yeah.
You have to have something at a World's Fair for everybody, you know, for
yes.
Hot rodders, for the women,
yeah.
For everybody.
Okay.
And so this sort of hit a broad scope.
Uh-huh. That's fascinating.
And it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you must have been very, very delighted with that.
It was good. And that was good duty. I enjoyed doing that very much because we had to have the modders working on cars because we had this diorama that the cars fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the diorama, you got everything up close is full size. Then as it goes out into the distance
mm-hmm.
for a limited area,
right.
You have to have everything scaled down to meet it. So all these little cars and stuff were running around the back, we had to have all the right scale cars running all the way back, and all these had to be modeled in detail so that they could be cast in fiberglass to fit on these tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a fantastic project to get the whole thing done.
So you were the Norman Bell Geddes of the 64-65 World's Fair.
Not really, because Jack Didion and his group got that whole thing together
mm-hmm.
and the ride vehicle. All I was responsible for was the transportation aspect of it.
Uh-huh.
We had a good time.
You brought in the idea of the dream cars, the show cars.
Yeah, we had that in there. But along with it, we got plaudits from Walt Disney, because Walt Disney used to stay at the same, we used to stay right across from the airport, because it was real close, because we used to fly in and out. And there was a short drive on that same expressway right out to the fair site.
Where was the fair site in those days?
Out of Flushing.
Still Flushing.
Yeah.
The site of the one in 1930.
Yeah, in the airport right across from there. What airport is that?
LaGuardia?
That's LaGuardia, yeah.
Yeah.
So we went into LaGuardia. So
Disney had done
Disney did a lot of things there. We used to talk to him, and Walt Disney thought that the concept we had was fantastic. He really did.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He had done something for Ford, hadn't he?
Yes.
In their exhibit at the 64-65 World's.
That's
Fair.
Right.
Yeah.
He had the
so
Ford
he was fascinated
stuff.
About the work that you and Didion were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He thought it was good. There's a lot of people involved in it. An awful lot of people were involved. Didion had hired an awful lot of people from all over industrial design groups,
mm-hmm.
added into the group to make their inputs. Yeah, and but they did a good job.
Have any of those prototypes, those fiberglass prototypes that you did for the World's Fair, have they survived? Are they still out at the tech center?
Well, I don't know where they are right now. I really don't. Sometimes the division needs a car, they put their identification on and show it in a
right.
showroom or somewhere, and then some keep them, they glom onto them, and some put them in their warehouses and so on. GM has not done a good job in their archives or in documenting their history and their recent history. They did in the old days, but not in their recent history and or in their photographic files
yeah.
or in keeping the prototypes of different models that they've got. They just scrap them. They break them up because they say storage space is necessary. Then you get a new management group in who have absolutely had nothing to do with the old stuff, you know, and so they have no interest in it whatsoever. So they can't see putting out part of their budget for warehouses to house this stuff of which they know nothing, and it had nothing to do. So it's just consequently thrown out. General Motors is always right up with what can you do for me now, right now.
And tomorrow.
Yeah. That's it.
They have no interest in the past.
No interest in the past. And I guess that's fine from a standpoint of making money,
yeah.
but you have to think about the people coming after us.
Right.
History. You need history.
Very important.
It's a very important thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about...
Well, your career has from about 1960 to about 1980, you're pretty much involved with the overseas operations.
A lot of the overseas, plus my advanced design groups, yeah.
Plus your advanced design,
yeah.
So you're shuttling back and forth.
So you're back and forth, and you get back here, and there's a fire on this, and a fire on Pontiac needs a front end, they got to have this, and building like the stuff did, that Humbert and the guys do, you got to need a new front end. So I get down there, and I said, Tuesday, let's stack these steel beams, and put one here, put this thing around here, and Bernie Smith was working for me then, he works for Holes now, and I said, do this, come in, I'll come back, and I want to see this. So they'd... they do it, and I make a sketch, sometimes even full size on the board, sometimes take tape and make it, try this one, try that one, and Bill would like it, take it up, and send the guys upstairs. It didn't turn out exactly maybe as we were doing, because it wasn't all detailed, but they got the concept, and they had a concept to start with. We did that on Cadillacs, we did on Pontiacs, Buick and Olds, all of them.
You've got six or seven design studios in the advanced area.
Yeah, plus a preliminary design. See, the preliminary design studio, we usually took the kids that, young fellows that we got from the schools, started them in preliminary design, and let them just work for a while on whatever they could come up with to sort of get a lot of the cobwebs out of their system and come up with their own without being tainted in General Motors requirements.
Yeah. Was Strother McMinn involved in this operation at all?
Strother McMinn, I knew Mac when I started General Motors. I started in Pontiac, in Oldsmobile Studio. Mac had a little studio, and he was working on one of the overseas cars. He was working on an Opel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was working, because I remember going on and saying, what the hell are you working on? Oh, I'm working on an Opel. Because he was a good friend of Johnny Foster.
Who was?
Who was one of the designers in, one of the senior designers in Oldsmobile. And Johnny Foster and McMinn lived together out in Grosse Pointe at some lady's house out there, you know. And they were both Californians. They knew each other in California. And Mac decided, well, he was going to return out there and teach at this Art Center school that had started out there. So he went back. But I remember Mac used to have a 36 cut-down Carson Top Ford. I remember going to a proving ground show out there with McMinn and Johnny Foster out there one time, yeah. And Mac didn't stay here too long, though. He went back out there. A real Carnot.
Yeah.
You know him?
No, I not met him, no.
Didn't you?
No, I'd like to go out and see the Art Center operation.
Yeah, Mac's a good guy. He doesn't teach there anymore.
Or doesn't he?
No, he's working for one of the Japanese design centers out there. And I don't know which one that is, whether it's Honda or Toyota. Maybe it's Toyota.
The Japanese are grabbing up all the good freelance designers these days.
Are they?
A lot of them, anyway.
Yeah, they probably are.
Yeah,
I can see why they would, yeah. Of course, see, the Japanese got a lot of their start. Are you still got a little time on that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Japanese got a lot of their start through American designers because Japanese, knowing that they were going in the car business, wanted to educate their designers. So they set them to Art Center School.
Uh-huh.
Well, Ford, Chrysler, and GM would go out to Art Center School and send their top people out there, like Chuck Jordan and our group, and I used to go out with Chuck and different people, and we'd give them a project out there, design to the young designers, design this for us. We'll be back a week from Tuesday to see how you're doing, and we'll have a crit at that particular time. And so they'd work day and night to get the stuff out. We'd see what they had, we'd select the stuff we thought was the best, then they would develop that. We'd go out in another 2 or 3 weeks, and they'd put on a whole show for us. These models would be all Dynoc, they'd be all painted up, they'd look great in scale model stuff, and they'd have full-size drawings in the bit.
Well, what 3/8 or quarters?
A lot of 3/8 models they would have out there. So they'd have full-size renderings and the whole bit. And so the Japanese were sending their people over, you see, and that meant that we would go out and criticize and tell them why this would work, why it wouldn't work, and we'd work with them and show them how our stuff was going and so on. Well, the Japanese kids are out there, they're getting all this kind of stuff. Then they take it straight back to Japan. And so they are being educated by our big three here. So Ford, Chrysler, and GM are really paying for their design, and they go back to Japan, and they've got all the stuff over there. Well, of course, you know, it's a logical outgrowth to just, they got a lot on their ball themselves, and they just continue
back and to have their own design studio in California, and
yeah,
hire good people like McMinn and others to work for them.
Yeah, so that's the way the thing went.
Well, at this point, I sense that there's a certain disenchantment in your career at this point. Somewhere in those intervening years between 60 and 80, that you're working like a Trojan, going back and forth, but yet it isn't quite what you had hoped to be.
Well, that's because of the people that I'm working for.
Yeah.
You see, after I didn't take this overseas assignment over at Opel, McKeegan took it over there. Meantime, he put me working for... it looked as though Chuck Jordan was going to be Bill's successor.
I
Bill made him design, big design man. Then they brought Irv up there, and Irv and Chuck were sort of, Irv Rubicki, who eventually got Bill's job, and they brought Irv up there, and he was running kind of neck and neck with Chuck. And they didn't know who was going to get it, and then Irv got the job. So Chuck is like an assistant to Irv, and there's not a good relationship between those fellows at all. Not by a long shot. No, there isn't. Well, so I was working for Chuck, then Chuck got the point where he didn't want to be around it there anymore. So he started taking off on the overseas thing a lot, mostly to Australia and over that way, because you were gone a longer time. But then Chuck is a... He can be a very nice, ingratiating sort of guy. I get along good with Chuck and his wife. They're both nice people. But Chuck, some days, for some reason or another, he comes in and he's like a different man. He comes in and he's angry. Nothing is right. Everything's got to be his way. And designers are, in order to be, their temperament is such, in order to come up with things and be the creative people they are, they're individuals. And it's hard for an individual to... be subordinate to a man who you can't understand, who runs hot and cold, and for some unknown reason doesn't like something and turns you off completely, rejects everything you're doing. And this is a very difficult thing. I've never had any run-ins with Chuck at all on that. But then what they did was, a guy overseas is only there for so long, so they bring another man back. So in that meantime, they brought McKeegan back. Well, McKeegan head back to the United States. So all these guys they keep bringing back, they got to find more jobs for them, see? So there's only so many jobs, so you got to divide up the pie. So they would divide up the pie, and they would take it partly away from me. So in other words, I had the overseas and the advanced stuff. They brought it back, and they brought back, and they gave McKeegan two of the advanced studios, or three advanced studios, I guess. Then they gave him preliminary design. Then after that, we were working side by side. Then they put him over me. And I ended up working for McKeegan. Now, McKeegan didn't like the fact that I was always taking stuff over there, and I didn't necessarily agree with what he was doing. And I would come back and tell the management here, aha, he's got a chance to stick it to me, which he did in many regards. And Mac was always playing up to Bill and his wife. Do I have time on this thing yet?
Yes, ma'am.
A couple minutes?
Yeah.
So, Mac was always playing up to Bill and his wife. They'd buy Mrs. Mitchell a nice fluffy little poodle dog over there, and they'd get this for her, and they'd buy her this, and they'd buy Bill a wristwatch, and they'd do this sort of thing, and they'd take him out to dinner, and, you know, the royal treatment. And so Mac got in pretty close with Bill in a lot of cases. Irv's case, Irv was a good guy. He didn't take the overseas thing, but Irv was a... He was a drinking buddy of Bill, and they're real, real good. This isn't to say that he doesn't have a lot on the ball. He does. He's a nice guy, and I like her. But in Chuck too, I don't like McKeegan. I wouldn't say anything nasty about him, but I don't like people that aren't honest and aren't up forward. And you can say something and tell them what you think, and they don't hold it against you. And Mac would necessarily leave me out of important meetings. He was the boss then, and so there'd be important meetings coming up with the top people downtown. Well, they all knew me. I knew them over the year. I worked with Pete Estes. Hi, Paul. Pete had come up, you know, and John DeLorean. How are they treating you? How's that going, you know? Well, I'm working for this clown, and he sends me over to Chicago or down out of town somewhere on some assignment, so I'll be gone when that meeting is here, and I won't be there when the top people come in. You know, and that's a devious, means of getting rid of somebody, and I was treated that way to a great extent. So, but anyway, I made the most of it during that time. So in the meantime, I saved by the bell.